Good afternoon, and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center webinar. I am Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the Jewish Policy Center and your host. I was going to welcome everyone back from the holidays with good wishes for the new year, but the horrific events of the past week have pretty much sunk any thoughts I had about that. And regular listeners know I try to be an optimist. I am pleased to have so many of you with us today. We've all been inundated with bits of information and so many terrible images. But I'm hoping today that we'll get a broader framework for understanding and evaluating what we get from the newspaper, from Twitter, from talking heads in the media, and from talking heads on television. We are pleased to bring Gabriel Noronha into our program today to look at the role of Iran in the invasion and the attacks by Israel, by its other proxy, Hezbollah. But before we go to Gabriel, I'm going to do our JPC commercial. The Jewish Policy Center was established in 1985 as a nonprofit organization providing analysis of foreign policy and defense. We support a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. Most important today, we support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them. And now more than ever, we support the government and the people of Israel and the IDF in their attempts to defend the Jewish state and bring the perpetrators of the massacres and the hostage takers to justice. You can find the JPC on our website, jewishpolicycenter.org. You'll find our writings about the current situation, and you will also find our magazine In Focus Quarterly. You can also find our previous webinar programs. And now to our guest. Gabriel Noronha is Executive Director of Polis National Security and a fellow at JINSA. From 2019 to 2021, Gabriel served as special advisor for the Iran Action Group at the State Department. He conducted policy that deprived the Mullah regime of about $200 billion. I have to say that twice, $200 billion that otherwise could have gone to support terrorism. And he directed the department's communications and congressional affairs regarding Iran. Prior to that, he worked as a special assistant for the Senate Armed Services Committee under Chairman John McCain and Jim Inhofe, helping to write, negotiate, and pass the annual National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA. He also worked for Senator Kelly Ayotte in 2015 and 2016. Most germane to what we're doing today, he speaks and conducts his research in Russian, Mandarin, and Spanish. And so he's got a handle on what people are saying in their own languages to their own people. And I am pleased to bring him to you, Gabriel Noronha. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Shoshana. Thank you all. Again, I have to start with condolences because I know a lot of you have either lost loved ones or people you know have. One of our researchers lost several friends over the weekend. I was supposed to be in Israel this week for a peace conference, working with the Abraham Accords members to strengthen peace. And that's actually where I want to start. And I'm going to put myself in the perspective of the policymakers in the Iranian regime right now, what they were thinking, what they've been doing, how they are thinking about this conflict and what they're trying to do. And then I'll end with a few things that we can do to counter this. So Iran saw the Abraham Accords and the Trump administration as a strategic collapse and defeat of a lot of their policy for decades, which had been intended to isolate and ultimately destroy Israel. What they were seeing in the last year was really troubling signs that Israel and Saudi Arabia would make peace. Those talks were nearing their conclusions. There were a number of technical issues that were outstanding, but they seemed to the Saudis and the Israelis to be resolvable. And so ultimately, what I believe Gaza and Hamas's strategy here was to completely disrupt that process from occurring. And Iran timed it and Hamas timed it very well in this regard. Their ultimate goal after there's the goal of killing as many Israelis and Jews as they can. A secondary and broader strategic political goal is, can you collapse Israel's rapprochement with its Arab neighbors? And the best way to do that is through what's happening now. through weaponizing images and pictures of dead Gazans, blown up mosques, and et cetera, in Gaza, and use that to foment discord and hatred of Israel among the Arab population. That's only possible through the information operations of Hamas and their sympathizers. I think everyone here knows that Hamas puts its headquarters in mosques, in hospitals, in schools. They put their weapons depots there so that Israel is forced to do that. But I want to back up a little bit more and talk about Iran and Hamas. Even though Hamas is a Sunni organization and Hezbollah shares a lot of those things, Iran, even which is a Shia state, hasn't hesitated to support Hamas and Hezbollah, as well as Palestinian Islamic Jihad in the West Bank. And they started their support for Hamas in 1992, giving about $50 million a year to them. That accelerated to $100 million by 1995. And that support continued all the way up to 2012, going as high sometimes as $300 million a year. In 2012, there was a bit of a schism, personality, politics mostly. And then that was patched up in 2017. In 2017, they had again resumed, and as a result of the JCPOA, had a lot of money to give again to Hamas. The other thing that they've been doing is doing the training, funding, equipping of Hamas fighter terrorists, not fighters, terrorists. They have even trained 6,500 terrorists at IRGC bases in southern Iran in the 2000s. They do provide the rockets and missiles that Hamas uses, as well as some of the weapons. But more importantly now is the technical know-how, the infrastructure to do it themselves. It is difficult for Iran to transport weapons and materials to Hamas, but they find ways, really creative ways to do so. The other thing Iran wants to do is create a strategic deterrent against Israel. And a lot of this is about protecting Iran from Israeli strikes. The way I think about it is Iran's conventional military, their air force, their navy, even their army is pretty pathetic. A lot of their equipment is from the 80s, 70s. It's obsolete. It cannot match Israel's F-35s, not by a long shot. And so Iran has always been worried that Israel would take out, say, its nuclear program or its air force in any type of conventional war. They cannot compete with Israel face to face there. And so what they've done is they've built a deterrent through Hamas and through Hezbollah primarily, creating a massive force of rockets and missiles on Israel's border as a deterrent to Israel, saying, if you strike our nuclear facilities, the first thing we will do is unleash that missile and rocket arsenal on Israel. That has been the single, greatest strategic problem for Israel, is saying we do not have enough Iron Dome interceptors to intercept even 15% of Hezbollah's arsenal here. And so one of the things that's really concerning is the idea that Hezbollah would launch an attack on Israel and make this a two-front war. Now, Israel is capable of winning a two-front war. They've won a three-front war in 1973. But that came at great cost. And that time, they did not have this kind of sophisticated and massive arsenal of rockets and missiles that could, frankly, in my concern, level many Iranian cities. Iran often talks about leveling, not Jerusalem, but they talk about leveling Haifa and Tel Aviv in particular. Those are cities that I would be deeply concerned about there. So Iran has been inculcating support in Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad I would treat those a little separately from Hezbollah here and what's about to happen. For them, Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad can go and cause as much trouble and do anything and just kill Israelis, deplete Israel's military arsenal. And that's for them, that can happen at any time. This was a really useful political moment for them to do this. Their deployment of Hezbollah against Israel is a little trickier for them. They can, if you use that tool, Israel will then go into Lebanon and wipe Hezbollah off entirely. They will destroy their missile and rocket arsenals. Some will be fired and destroyed at Israel. Some will fire and destroy Israeli cities. And then the Israeli military will destroy a lot of this arsenal. The strategic issue for Iran in that case is what happens after that. They no longer have that strategic deterrent that they had hoped to use to protect their nuclear program or their conventional military against Israel. And so as we've seen, Israel is willing and will certainly take vengeance and create deterrence against what's happened here. Iran does not want to be the target of that vengeance. They want to use their proxies. That's why they have them there, so that they can take the brunt. They can do the fighting for them. They can do the dying for them. They can use their weapons. And then they get the idea of deniability here. So there's been a big question in on TV and at the White House and Republicans versus the administration here on Iran's direct culpability here. Right at the outset, there were sort of denials from the administration that this was caused by Iran. And yet Iran was out there saying, we fully support this. We have their back. We then saw the picture change over the last few days. First, you saw the Wall Street Journal report that Iran had actually directed, planned, and executed this attack. You then started seeing the number of casualties mount in Israel, and we started understanding the sheer horror of what Hamas had done. And I think what we saw in Tehran was them saying, oh, we may have bitten off a little bit more than we could chew here. And so you started seeing denials from Iran replace their earlier confirmations. They said things like, we cheer on Hamas. This was a phenomenal thing, but we had nothing to do with it. And that's because, again, they are trying to prevent themselves from being attacked here. They do not want U.S. or Israeli strikes against their oil infrastructure, against their military infrastructure, or ultimately their nuclear infrastructure. It's important, though, as the public and as policymakers, to understand that Iran, whether or not they ordered this attack, whether or not they planned this particular attack, is solely responsible for the results of it, solely along with Hamas. Because when you give $100 million a year, which according to a senior government official told me, that constitutes 90% of Hamas's military budget. When you fund something 90%, you own it. And so you own the decision-making and you own the consequences for what that group does. And so that's important in this discussion, is to understand there's the intelligence of, did a certain Iranian general give a command? Perhaps not. But at the end of the day, if you give all the weapons and money for an operation, you are responsible. So Iran is now going to backtrack and try to cover some of these tracks because they want deniability. They want to be able to enjoy the profits of what they've done, but they don't want to have to deal with the consequences and responsibility. One thing that is going to happen now at this point of the war is Iran is going to try to bolster up its allies with all the military equipment and weapons needed to fight Israel, just in case. So one thing that we saw Israel do this morning, U.S. time, is they bombed the airstrips at Damascus and Aleppo airports in Syria. That happened because Iran was en route with its foreign minister and likely a lot of weapons on the same plane to Damascus. And so the Iranian foreign minister was on the plane, and they were, again, coordinating how to best encircle Israel. It's unclear to me, I don't have the intelligence, whether or not Hezbollah or Syrian forces may actually join this war. This strikes me as that we are still in the early days of what's about to happen. Iran senses vulnerability here, and I think they sense weakness because of the state of how Israel was unprepared, fortunately, for this attack. So Israel's struck Syrian airports. They have not yet struck many targets in Lebanon for Hezbollah. There have been a few fighters killed, of Hezbollah terrorists killed, but it has not broken out more. There are urgent sort of diplomatic efforts to try to make sure that doesn't happen. The U.S. and others have sent messages to Hezbollah and Iran saying you better not enter this. Unfortunately, Iran hasn't been taking U.S. threats very seriously recently. As one example data point, Iranian forces over the last 2.5 years have attacked U.S. forces 83 times in the Middle East. We've only responded on 4 occasions. That teaches bad lessons to Iran that they can get away with attacks against U.S. forces, attacks against U.S. allies and partners, and get away with it. This is something that we experienced when I was working in the Trump administration. President Trump didn't respond to a lot of Iranian provocations, and Iran thought that they could get away with a lot more, and they ultimately had their Iraqi forces attack and try to invade the U.S. embassy in Baghdad. We had to try to reset deterrence by killing Qasem Soleimani in response. Deterrence, the idea that your enemy is going to, you know, respond, isn't a yes or no. It's sort of a scale. It's a sliding scale, and you can have more deterrence, less deterrence. For Israel right now, there are accusations within the Israeli government. I'm not going to weigh in on domestic politics, that basically they lost a little bit of that deterrence, particularly against Hamas. What the Israeli government now is going to try to do is restore that deterrence as far as it can possibly go, to send a message that attacks against Israel won't be tolerated and will be extremely extreme. I'll go briefly into things the U.S. can do in response. The first thing, which is being litigated really heavily, is the $6 billion ransom payment that was given to Iran last month. That was in exchange for 5 American hostages who had been held in Iran. We freed 5 Iranian prisoners who had been convicted under U.S. law. But then we also allowed Iran access to $6 billion of its oil funds that had been frozen under sanctions in 2018 and 2019. That money is likely going to be frozen. There have been a number of bills in Congress introduced just yesterday to that effect. And so if people are thinking about things that they can ask their members of Congress to do, supporting that legislation is one of the most important things. That money, there are lots of claims that will go to humanitarian areas. It's misleading for a couple of reasons. One is fungibility. Basically, the notion, if I got $6 billion in my savings account, I would spend on my credit cards or on my saving or on my checking account and use that money. The other issue is that Iran has a really troubling history of misappropriating medicine and food. They have, in 2019, for example, when Iran was claiming that they had difficulty accessing medicine, they sent 19 trucks across the border to Iraq. They were trying to sell it on the black market, and they were going to use those funds to support terrorism. So that's how the Iranian system works. It's not intended to help the Iranian people. It's intended to fund terror proxies and that terror machine. So first, that $6 billion can be frozen. The broader issue here is since the start of 2021, Iran has been able to export $80 billion in oil, largely to China, and U.S. sanctions on Iranian oil hasn't been enforced. They went 13 months or 15 months without sanctioning any entity or individual for the oil. And it's been unfortunately rather weak since then. Those are the two single most important things that the United States and Europe, I should add, should be involved here. The last one, and then I'll go to questions. In 6 days, The UN's arms embargo against Iran's suicide drone and ballistic missile program will expire. These sanctions were put on back in 2006, 2007. They were permanent then. In 2015, in the nuclear deal, the Iranians allowed or got themselves that sanction to eventually expire in what then was 8 years away. That is now 6 days away. And so on next Wednesday, Iran will legally, under international law, be able to export ballistic missiles and suicide drones to Hamas, to Hezbollah, and to Russia for their war against Ukraine. That is something that the international community should not allow. They have the legal right to snap back those sanctions. Europe is kind of in the lead for that, for reasons I'm happy to elaborate on. But that's something that should happen at the UN immediately. With that, I'll go to questions and happy to answer anything.
Thank you very much, Gabriel. It gives us a perspective. I'm going to start where you started, and that is with Iran's concerns about the Abraham Accords. Clearly, the Saudis and the Israelis have made a lot of progress on whether and how to deal with each other. Do you think that the Saudis are likely to be deterred by Iran's behavior, or that the other Abraham Accords countries might be deterred? Could they believe that they will be subject to attack if they move on with Israel? How do you see it going for Israel and its partners?
So one of Saudi's troubles when it comes to normalizing relations with Israel is basically about the Palestinian issue. At the end of the day, a lot of the Muslim world is deeply concerned with Israel and Palestinian issues. And they have always historically had the position, we won't normalize with Israel until there's a solution to the Palestinian problem. In the Abraham Accords, what you saw was the UAE, Bahrain, and Morocco saying, we don't care. The Palestinians haven't helped themselves. They've turned down every offer. Abbas is corrupt. Hamas are terrorists. We're done. Saudi Arabia hasn't gotten to that point. And what they've sort of said is, we want some concessions on Palestinian issues, whether that's territory settlements, final status issues. They want some concessions. To be honest, that was basically just for domestic purposes. It was so that MBS and the King Salman could get it through their system. They don't personally, MBS does not really care about the Palestinian issue or cause. What he wants is security guarantees from the United States. He wants cooperation from the United States and possibly Israel on their nuclear program. And they want to be part of sort of a regional security construct. They want their needs protected. They want their interests advanced. But the issue now is with these attacks, the Saudi public and the rest of the Muslim world and Muslim countries are likely to gain a lot more sympathy for the Palestinian cause than they've had for a long time. Frankly, they've been of the view recently, Palestinians, they keep making mistakes. It's their own problem. We don't care. And again, the single thing that will be most powerful about this war is the inevitable issue, you know, the inevitable scene of dead Palestinian civilians, which, to be clear, is a tragedy and should be avoided. We know the Israeli government goes out of their way to avoid civilian casualties. We know that Hamas goes out of their way to put human shields in the way of bombs so that their dying can be and their deaths can be used as a political weapon. So I think in terms of, to your question, will Saudi back away? It's too soon to say. I think a lot of it depends on the nature of how Israel does things the next week or two. And then to me, the question of, is Israel going back into Gaza? Are they going to take management there? And then what is the view among the Muslim community of what ought to happen there? My guess is Saudi Arabia is going to sort of increase their ask for concessions on Palestinian issues. And the direction the Israeli public is going is saying, we want zero concessions whatsoever. And that mismatch right there is going to be the hardest thing to breach. It has made this peace deal much harder than it was a week ago.
So the Iranians can claim at least that as a success.
Absolutely. I think they have likely already succeeded in this endeavor.
So you mentioned that we, not all of us, but some of us in the West do understand that Palestinian casualties, which are tragic and which are to be mourned and which are not a happy and healthy thing, are in large measure the result of steps taken by Hamas and by other Palestinian organizations to put people in harm's way. So we know that. The U.S. government appears to know it more or less. But are you making the case that there are a lot of places in the world where either they don't know it or they don't care about it? Do we have to do a better job of understanding and explaining what's actually going on? What's our obligation here?
So great question. I think, I was really, I was surprised to see yesterday the amount of moral clarity from this administration on the Israel question I hadn't seen in a while. To me, it was the sense that the people in charge understood truly what was happening here and the moral situation. That's really tough in the media environment where we have a lot of pro-Hamas influencers who are going to tweet out lots of videos and post on Instagram and TikTok, which are areas where the pro-Israel community aren't quite as active, unfortunately. And they're simply going to show a video of, rubble, a dead Palestinian child, or a mother grieving. And all of these things are going to be recycled from Syria. They're going to use videos of things that happened in Syria 10 years ago by Assad, or they're going to use things from past wars. This I've seen the amount of these things I've already seen online and had to go and debunk and say, this is from this camp in Syria, which Assad shelled. That happens a lot. That is very difficult to fight, because the moment you've seen that video, if you're an average, let's say, Pakistani citizen, you're not going to go and say, is this video real? Is that from Aleppo or is that from Gaza? And so this is the role where those of us who support Israel and the action that they're taking have to be sort of vigilant hawks in trying to get the powers that be on the social media platforms to rightly flag and identify, hey, this is actually not from Gaza, this is from 2014. It is an uphill battle. The last conflict that, and I'm blanking on, maybe this was even just in May, maybe this was last year, or this was 2021. What I saw was that battle had been lost in the information space. You saw the number when you did polling of young people in particular, vast majorities saying they based on the images that they saw. So again, the whole point of this is an information war. That is how they advance their political objectives. Their means are kinetic and using terrorists, but their most potent weapon is these videos weaponizing outrage to again blame Israel for all of this. And I would say if the pro-Israel community wants to fight back, it requires investment in people who do social media and can fight back on this.
And I suppose it also means, you talked about an average Pakistani citizen or an average citizen of the Muslim world wouldn't know differently and would respond to the video as it is. But it's also important, I guess, to keep Western governments and other governments on the right page. Yes, the U.S. government has been really adamant and really good right now on this. And most of Western Europe has been really good about this. But I guess a lot of attention has to be directed to governments as well. Because you also said that the UN embargo on Iranian ballistic missile and lethal drones is about to expire this week. And we can't let it. It can't be allowed to happen. On the other hand, Iran already violates the embargo. So twofold question. Is there actually an embargo? Number one, how good is it or how leaky is it? And number two, how likely is it that the countries of the UN will come together and say, this is not the time, to cut off the embargo?
So I'll answer the first question first. It is unlikely that the European government will have a come to Jesus moment. They are frankly led by individuals who have sought to appease Iran for decades. This is not European citizens. This is not European heads of state per se. This is sort of the bureaucracy there in the foreign ministries is frankly highly misguided. And that kind of goes back to your earlier point. You have to do education of college students, of young professionals on these things early. Once you get into a view in government, you tend to stick to it is the thing that I've found. Facts change things on occasion, but your ideological worldview shifts a lot. To the embargo, so it's been in place with not great effect. Iran violates it serially. And the issue is that the international community, and again, Europe is primarily to blame here, doesn't impose consequences when that happens. They issue statements and strongly worded tweets, and they usually call it at that. It's this serial problem of believing that rhetoric is action. Rhetoric is not action. Rhetoric is just rhetoric. In terms of what happens if you actually restore this ban, the big thing here is third countries. So the issue that what the UN ban does is it says a country like India, for example, you can't facilitate any of these transfers. You can't buy Iranian weapons. You can't give them technical components. That's important for countries outside the US who are going to say, well, what's my international obligation? What is my UN obligation? So it's at the margins, but those margins are really important about getting the material, getting the things inside Iran that can make that difference. The other thing that's important is it gives the United States an international legal standing to, for example, intercept shipments. We have interdicted about 5 shipments of millions of guns, ammunition, tanks, anti-tank missiles, anti-ship missiles en route from Iran to Yemen. That's been because of the UN arms embargo on Yemen. We also were able to use the UN arms embargo on Iran at the time. Today, and especially in 7 days, we won't be able to use that legal authority anymore. And so if you have weapons en route to Lebanon, we will have zero legal authority to do anything here under international law. We can still use domestic laws, but it, again, when you're in the room with lawyers, it's always nice to be able to have another UN resolution that you can cite on your side.
So essentially, it's words without action. One of the things that we had already discovered was that the Iranian drones that went to Russia for use in Ukraine had Chinese parts. So you have a large piece of the world, China, it's a big piece of the world all by itself. You have China deciding that the embargo on those kinds of parts to Iran was not in their national interest. And so they ignored it. And we ignored it. So yeah, we have to go beyond rhetoric to action. I'm not very optimistic about that. Question from a listener. Egypt. There are stories that Egypt tried to warn Israel about the impending attack, which would have been helpful. Also stories that Egypt will not permit Gaza refugees to go to Egypt. Where's Egypt in this?
So what you saw was Egyptian claims that they briefed Netanyahu personally on this. Mm-hmm. Netanyahu issued a statement pretty quickly denying it. However, what I noted, and again, I don't have access to the intelligence, is chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Mike McCall, who's a Republican, very pro-Israel, after a briefing basically said, yes, the Egyptians did brief this. That's a question Israel is going to have to do a lot of digging into. After the 73 war, there was a massive inquiry about intelligence failures. There were clearly intelligence failures here on both sides. Egypt, to my view, would not want this war to happen because now they are seeing this massive crisis on their border with Gaza. They do not want 1 million, 2 million Gazan refugees coming into Egypt. One, because most countries don't want refugees. They don't want to have to take care of their material needs. The other issue is they aren't sure that Israel would let them back in. It's certainly a possibility that if you saw Gaza emptied of its population, Israel would, and very justifiably, I think, after what we've seen, say Gaza is now annexed. It is now part of Israeli territory. We are wiping this clean, and that's it. So Egypt, in my view, understandably says, this is your problem. we tried to, and in their view, I don't know if this is true. They said, we tried to warn you. We didn't want this to happen. Now that it has, this is your problem. The Israeli answer is sort of, look, Gazans keep saying they have nowhere to go. Actually, they do. They have Egypt. So they are trying to say this is Egypt's problem. There are no easy answers to this. I do not pity the Israeli government right now trying to figure out what happens after you take out Hamas. Again, Hamas is embedded deeply. There's 30,000 terrorists, but there's also a whole political structure. You can eliminate their whole leadership, which should be done. But then the question is, you know, are you able to dismantle them root and stem? The United States tried to do that with Al-Qaeda and it's still going on and we still haven't succeeded. Who runs the Gaza Strip? Are we going back in? These are not easy questions. There are no good answers, frankly. Everyone that thinks there's a good answer, I think is a little optimistic.
So this brings up another question that we were sent in. And it is forward looking, and maybe there simply isn't an answer yet. But the question is, will the Gaza government, the Hamas government, survive the attack? And if it doesn't, what replaces it? It's very difficult, I think, to get consensus for international action. It's very difficult to get an Israeli government to say, yeah, we'll run it, you know, we'll do it ourselves. What are the possibilities?
So first, Hamas's leadership is largely based in Qatar. They do that so that they can get meetings with other people, so they can get access, a little bit like the fact that Taliban's leadership was, until they took back Afghanistan, was also based in Qatar. Now, that Qatar is a complicated U.S. partner. We have an air base there, Al Udeid, where we have a lot of important military assets. There, in the case of the Taliban, they were kind of an interlocutor there. Hamas now has sort of terror leadership there. It's there again. There was a little bit of difference between between Taliban leadership and say Al Qaeda versus ISIS leadership. What Hamas has done in the last week has shifted Hamas into an Al Qaeda ISIS like entity. I do not expect that they will be alive a year from now. The method and means by which that happens is unclear. If I were Israel, anyone that's been paying attention the last 75 years knows that Israel has the means and the willingness to take out people anywhere in the world when they wish to mean harm to Israel. I suspect that will happen. Again, you will see new leadership in Hamas. Hamas will not likely evaporate. It will suffer a massive setback. You know, if I had to take a wild guess, I would say 2/3 of its force is going to be killed over the next month or so. That leaves 10,000, and that leaves a lot of people who are going to be grieved in the Gaza Strip who are going to rejoin Hamas. This is the start of a new war. It is far from over.
On the other side of the arms discussion, the United States has said that it would help Israel replace its military stocks that are being used in Gaza right now. But the United States had actually also depleted the U.S. stocks that were stationed permanently in Israel. They took them out for use in Ukraine some months ago. What do you know about restoration of U.S. stocks in Israel?
So JINSA for a long time had been advocating that the U.S. government replenish the stockpile. There are some weapons that aren't necessarily needed for this fight that were needed for Ukraine's defense. There's also a debate in Congress. There's some people saying, we need to focus on Taiwan and China. That war is a completely different war than this war. You know, Hamas does not have advanced fighter jets. They do not have amphibious vessels. Those are things that Taiwan needs to deal with. So separate wars, and same, you know, Hamas does not have tanks either. Hezbollah does, but different things. So there is an $8 billion drawdown of existing U.S. weapons that the Pentagon authorized to be given to Israel. But that does not include money for Iron Dome interceptors. It does not include funding for precision-guided munitions, which Israel needs not just for its defense, but if you want to say that Israel should limit its civilian casualties in Gaza, everyone should want precision-guided missiles that reduce collateral damage. The other thing they need is protective equipment. I'm sure a lot of you have been seeing, you have IDF reservists coming in and saying, hey, our gloves are 40 years old, our helmets are from post-73. And so we need to get sort of just basic protective equipment in, and then finally intelligence support. Ultimately, the question here is for Congress is how are we funding everything? We did a continuous resolution 2 weeks ago that didn't fund the border, it didn't fund Ukraine, it didn't fund anything for Taiwan, and it barely funded the Pentagon. Now, on top of that, we have the fifth one, Israel. So there's going to have to be a robust spending fight in Congress. And my hope is that we spend a lot more on all five of those things, because that's what the Constitution requires.
So let me jump in here because you worked on the Hill. And just make something clear for the people that are listening. The House can't bring a bill to the floor right now, right? Because there's no House Majority Leader. So everything is stuck until they solve the problem of the leader. Is that right?
That is mostly correct. They can do, basically, it's kind of a new ground here. It is possible, but it is very unprecedented for any legislation to be introduced unless you have a speaker. We now have a nominee, Steve Scalise. He has the Republican majority, but he doesn't necessarily have enough of his colleagues to get him to 218. What you might see is Democrats saying, hey, he's not our pick, but we might actually vote for him just to get him in the job and have him start things. That's possible. The Senate's also not in session this week. They don't go into session until next Monday. So part of this is there's a little time for that to happen. Either way, the staff have to write these bills. They've been working all weekend. They are close to getting that done, but they could use a couple extra days as well. What's really important is that no one block things, no one spend extra time gumming up the works.
So we're coming to the end of our program. For the listeners, I promised Gabriel a hard out at 12:45 because he has a plane to catch. So as we come to the end, though, my normal optimism has been dissipated because what I see, and you've reinforced some of the things I was thinking, the arms embargo wasn't all that good. Even if the $6 billion is refrozen, Iran has foreign currency reserves that will take care of its needs and its terrorism aspirations for a long time to come. Congress is stymied. What's the good news here? Where are we going?
I will say the good news here is what I saw from American elites, from American companies, from Europeans, was moral clarity for once. That this was an act of terrorism, that there was nothing that Israel could have done that would possibly justify the horrific things. And what we are seeing is, you know, you had the typical college radicals say things like, oh, we stand with Palestine and all these acts were justified. You were seeing those people having their job offers rescinded. That's unprecedented, frankly. That's overdue. If any of those people had written after 9/11 and said, we stand with Al-Qaeda, everything was a U.S. provocation, they could have been locked up in jail for support for a terrorist organization. And you're starting to see American elites and European policymakers coming and saying, this is terrible. You've seen a massive reckoning, I think, on in the Democrat Party of saying, we're done with this, we're not tolerating this, we're not tolerating the DSA, which is holding these rallies. That is, you know, that is the silver lining, and it should not have taken this to cause it. This is an opportunity, again, to use that moral clarity and talk to people who might disagree with you and say, have you reconsidered? Are you willing to reconsider after what we just see?
That's a really important point. That wreckage, as awful as it is, and as terrible as this week has been, it's an opportunity to realign ourselves on the side of the good and the right and the just, and help our friends and have moral clarity. Gabriel Noronha, thank you very much. This has been a good way for us to think about how to think about it. And we appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it all.